Senate Finance will come to order. My name is Senator Green, and with me today are Senator Bundy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, and Co-Chair Wilken. And we have a pretty full calendar today, beginning with Senate Bill 305, and then House Bill 357, House Bill 394, House Bill 400, and House Bill 408. I know there's an amendment. Has it been distributed? No? Okay. Are there any questions or discussion this morning? Any information? Robin, you want to come forward in case anyone has a question? We also have, I think, is Rob Mintz on the line?
Yeah.
Okay. Is anyone else?
For 408.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Very good. We have an amendment to pass out. What's that?
Hey, he's warning you, can't look at no more figures. You have to make up your mind now.
Drill in the customer.
It is.
304.
You don't know now. You're not going to know. Take all your papers off the table.
Okay, I think you have before you amendment number 7. And this is in response to some of the Senator Dyson questions and some technical adds that resulted from that. And the last section is the current attempt at the sort of remote gas treatment facilities. I think I've said that correctly. And is Rob going to walk us through this, or are you going to walk us through this, Robin?
For the record, my name is Robin Wilson, Director of Tax Division. I believe I'll ask Mr. Mintz to walk through, and
okay.
I'll be available for questions.
Okay. Senator Bundy, do you have a question?
I can't hear very well.
Oh, okay. Robin, you're going to have to get closer to your mic when you speak, okay? Thank you. Senator Wilken, would you move amendment number 7?
Madam Chair, move amendment number 7, object for discussion.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much. Rob, you want to walk us through amendment number 7, please, which is one that begins with page 5, line 24. Rob? Rob Mintz? Okay, Robin, go ahead and begin, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and if Rob comes back online, he's welcome to chime in here.
Madam Chair, I guess I was muted before.
Okay, Rob, thank you. It's good to have you online. If you could walk us through the amendment, and if you want to kind of it's several different pieces all together that are not necessarily connected but are, for convenience, put in this one amendment. So if you would kind of delineate it for us as we go, please.
Sure. This is the one that begins with page 5, line 24.
That's correct.
Okay. The first three parts of this, which add subsection G to the citation AS 4355011E, simply fills a gap that was left in the CS regarding the taxation of the royalty share of oil. Section 9 of the bill on page 5 does two things. The first sentence, which is just slightly revised from current law, just states the general rule that a producer that is paying the tax on royalty oil and gas can collect that tax back from the royalty owner. What the new material does...
Rob, excuse me. Are you on the multi-page, five-page amendment? That begins...
Yes, actually, I'm on a four-page amendment.
Okay, that, I'm looking at the one that has page 5, line 24, following month, insert a comma.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, there are two amendments that start on page 5, line 24, maybe that's...
Oh, that's probably the confusion, thank you.
All right. Now that I'm on the right amendment, yesterday there was a question about possibly adding a comma in this rather long sentence. And we looked at this again, and it appeared that, yes, it would help legibility to do that, and that the appropriate place to add the commas was to set off the phrase on lines 24 to 26, other than oil and gas, the ownership or right to which constitutes a lessor's royalty interest under an oil and gas lease, because there's a separate tax under AS 4355-011F that applies to that lessor's royalty share.
Okay.
And so what this sentence does in the bill is to provide a kind of default formula for calculating the royalty share of the tax when it's a different kind of royalty, not a lessor's royalty interest under an oil and gas lease. Typically, this would be what's called an overriding royalty that's carved out of the working interest or lessee's interest. So because that's an exception, this whole phrase is an exception, it makes sense to set it off with commas and makes for easy reading. That's all. That's the only purpose there.
Okay, so lines 1 through 5 on our amendment are sort of the first section.
That's correct.
Okay, now go through lines 7 through 11 on our amendment.
And this adds the term explorer after producer.
Okay, and that's as a result of the conversation we had yesterday as well, is it not?
Yeah, well, actually there are probably over a dozen of these that, and this all has to do with the transitional investment expenditure credit. Now, AS 4355-024, which is Section 12 of the bill, establishes three different types of credit: the qualified capital expenditure credit, the net loss carry forward credit, and then the transitional investment expenditure credit. Now, the first two, it already provides that either a producer or explorer can take advantage of that. The reason being that if you're an explorer that doesn't have any production tax, you can still benefit from the credit because you can transfer it through the transferable tax credit certificate. On the other hand, the transitional investment expenditure credit is expressly non-transferable. So in the original language there, it only refers to a producer because a producer is the only type of entity that could benefit from the credit. However, at the bottom of page 2 of the amendment, there's a proposal to add a new twist on the credit under this entire section. And basically, if you're a small producer or an explorer, you can take your credit either against the production tax or against the corporate income tax. Well, that means that you can benefit from the transitional investment expenditure even at the time that you're not producing anything. And so therefore, to make it clear that an explorer could take advantage of the credit, all of these little changes from line 7 on page 1 of the amendment through line 23 on page 2 of the amendment, basically wherever there's a reference to producer,
okay,
in the transitional investment expenditure provision, it's changed so it refers to producer or explorer. So then to explain the actual substantive change, which is allowing a credit against the income tax in certain circumstances, that's the part that starts on line 25 of page 2, and it would insert a new subsection in AS 4355.024. And what it says is, if a producer or explorer doesn't produce more than 50,000 barrels of oil in a year, and that's actually oil equivalent, we've I think seen that concept in 170, where you add up the oil and the gas, and you convert the gas to a barrel at the rate of 6,000 cubic feet, equaling a barrel. So anyway, if your production is that small, you're allowed to apply your tax credits under 024 either against your production tax or your income tax. I think that's pretty straightforward. And if there are no questions on that, I'll go.
Are there any questions on from page, it's actually page 1, line 7 of the amendment, till to through page 3, line 9. Any questions, Senator Stedman?
In the previous, thank you, Madam Chairman, in the previous committee, we took out references to the applicability of the credit against the corporate income tax, and the my understanding is this is in reference in with the look back provision, which is geared for the major producers, and I'm just curious why we're going to allow it to come against the corporate income tax with the am I misinterpreting something here?
Rob, can you respond, please?
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Stedman. Of course, this is a policy call, but here's my understanding. The reason that the legislation up to now has said that you can only take the credit against the production tax is basically to protect state revenues against unduly large hits, and so that at least if the production tax tanks, at least we'll be able to have the income tax. And I think what this amendment would do is probably not very materially damage that goal, because it's limited to just those producers that have very small production. So it's a way of getting the benefits of the tax credits to small producers without opening up the income tax to to large hits.
That answer your question?
Yeah, I'm still kind of curious, Madam Chairman, what the intent is here, because we've got two basic pieces. One of them is geared for the larger producers, where they have a look-back provision. The other one is a barrel exclusion for the smaller. And I'm just kind of, I recognize that this is 50,000 barrels a year on line 28, page 2.
Text
yes, Madam Chairman, Senator Stedman. I mean, actually, the original thought was it would apply to someone that's not producing at all, but 50,000 is so small that it just allows a modest amount of production. I think the answer to your question about why we would be doing this when transitional investment expenditure or lookbacks intended to benefit the large producers who've already made a lot of investment is there is at least one and possibly more companies that do have significant investments in the last few years that don't have production or don't have significant production, and they, I guess in concept, they should be able to benefit from transitional investment expenditure credit, and this would ensure that they could.
Further questions? Robin, can you offer any other explanation or kind of enlighten us
yes,
at all?
If I might, yes, that's exactly the rationale as I understand it. The 50,000 barrel works out to about 150 barrels a day, so it definitely is for the very small producers. And what has been observed is that, you know, these producers may have credits that are unused in the production tax area, but on the other hand are paying state income tax. And the reason that they are paying state income tax potentially is that they have production in the rest of the, you know, the rest of their business, the rest of the country. And because we tax a piece of the worldwide business, then in effect that income is apportioned some small way, but it's apportioned to Alaska, and so they easily can end up with a corporate income tax liability while having these credits unused on the production tax side.
Madam Chairman, there was, I think, a fairly extensive analysis done on the look-back provision as far as the exposure to the state on revenue, and I assume that with one or two companies that we've got a general idea of the cost of this, potentially?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, if you're asking how much of the assumed capital expenditures over the last 5 years had to do with the small companies, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I think it was fairly small. My recollection is about $250 million, but again, I don't have the numbers in front of me on that. So it was a small amount compared to the expenditures from the major producers.
Further questions?
No, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Continue, please, Rob. Beginning on line 11 on page 3 of the amendment.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I believe yesterday there was a question raised about the current language in AS 4355-150A shown on page 17 of the bill, where there are three criteria listed for when reasonable costs are to be substituted for actual costs. And it was suggested that these three criteria should be connected by the word and. And this is, in fact, how the statute has been interpreted and implemented in the past by the Department of Revenue. So unless Robin says something different, my assumption is that the administration would go along with adding the word and. And I just want to emphasize that, in our view, this would simply be clarifying existing law and not intended to actually change existing law.
Okay. Any questions on that addition of the word and on line 6 of page 17? Okay. Next item.
Okay. This has to do with a list of exclusions from deductible costs in calculating lease expenditures. And I'm sorry, this is actually not the exclusions, but examples of what costs are considered direct costs. And D1B on line 17 and 18 of page 20 says that direct costs include payments of property taxes, sales and use taxes, motor fuel taxes, and excise taxes. Now, there's some situations where a producer makes a payment in lieu of taxes. It does the same function, but it's just not literally a tax. I believe that's true with the North Slope Borough in some cases. And so just to clarify that the bill does not mean to exclude payments in lieu of taxes, the proposal would be to insert a language in this provision that says that payments of or payments in lieu of property taxes, sales taxes, et cetera, are considered direct costs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any questions on that? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What are some examples of that then?
Well, the only one I'm aware that is currently in effect, and I think Robin may have more information on it, but I believe that the North Slope Borough pays some. Oh, I guess it's not the North Slope Borough paying tax. I think that the producers pay make a payment to the North Slope Borough that basically is in lieu of taxes for certain services.
Such as what?
Personally, I'm afraid I don't recall, Senator.
If I might.
The problem, I guess, is that this leaves a pretty wide open field, and who's going to be determining this?
Robin.
Yes, if I might, Madam Chair. Yes, it is. I understand that there's a tax paid to the North Slope Borough in lieu of property tax. What this amendment does is it's very specific to property tax, so it's and Rob can correct me if my understanding is incorrect, but I believe the original bill said payments in lieu of property tax. There've been some iterations of the bill, obviously. It does not now say in lieu of property tax, and this just clarifies that it does. I would point out that this this list of direct costs is not inclusive, but it points out specific areas where there might be confusion. One might say, well, is a tax direct to a lease? And this list includes a clarification that payments for property taxes are in fact deductible direct expenses, and this amendment simply clarifies that a payment made in lieu of that tax will be treated the same as an actual property tax.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I understand that, but I'm wondering who's going to be making this determination of this tax?
Madam Chair, yes, Senator, I do have to correct a little bit something. The in lieu of it would apply to each of the taxes listed under D1B, property, sales and use, motor fuel tax, and excise tax. I think the concept of payments in lieu of taxes is not that novel, because it wouldn't really apply here, but examples in the past would be tax-exempt institutions that are not obligated to pay taxes, but do anyway. For example, universities and sometimes churches. But in this case, there may be arrangements where, in order, just by agreement, a producer pays something that substitutes for a tax, but it's not literally a tax. And since it serves the same function economically, it seems appropriate to make clear that it should get the same treatment for purposes of lease expenditures.
Senator Hoffman, do you have further questions?
No, thank you, ma'am.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Minson, I'm not sure who to ask this question of, but you said made a comment that there was payments were made to the North Slope Borough for services, and I'm assuming you're retracting that statement, that sentence.
Madam Chairman, Senator, and I have to apologize. I'm not familiar in detail with the situation. I just heard Dan Dickinson refer to this as so I don't know whether it is tied to specific services or whether it's just a substitute for a general tax.
Okay, thank you. And the last question I have for you, it sounds like the way you're setting it up with the PILT payments that are there, that there is, you can either pay the state or pay the borough. And if that is the case, there seems to be a tension between whether the money is going to be going specifically to a borough or the borough or the state. Is that indeed what you were saying?
Madam Chair, Senator, I hope this is responsive to your question, but the taxes that are listed here would be considered direct costs regardless of what jurisdiction they're paid to, whether it's local or state.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Rob, let me see if I understand this. So if the producer or producers pay to the North Slope Borough some amount that's in lieu of taxes for some particular project. You mentioned the university or some other arrangement that they have made between those two bodies, then that is reduced, that is deducted from the exposure to the person, to the PPT. Therefore, the people of Alaska participate in that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator, the short answer is yes. I mean, actually, all this section does is say what are direct costs and what are not direct costs. In order to be deductible, they have to be direct, ordinary, and necessary. So, in theory, you don't automatically become deductible just because you're direct. But in practice, I would expect that the taxes that are directly tied to the oil and gas exploration, production, or development activities would be deductible. And yes, that would basically, under the 22.5% rate, that would be shared 22.5% by the state.
Okay, then where in government, in state government, would there be a list of the last 5 years of those PILT payments to from the producers to the North Slope Borough? Does that reside somewhere?
Madam Chair and Senator, I don't have any personal knowledge of that. I'm sorry.
Where would I go, do you think, Rob, to get that information?
I hate to put Robin on the spot, but I would think the Department of Revenue would be more likely to have it than most people.
Okay,
if
thank
it
you.
Exists.
All right, thank you, Rob. Rob?
Yes, through the Chair, Senator Wilkin. I'm sorry, could you clarify, are you asking for the where we would have the amounts of those, or?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I am not aware that we formally have that information. I certainly don't have it at my fingertips today. I'm not sure whether our property tax people in our division keep track of that or how that works.
Yes.
Would it be right if I asked Robin to research that, and if you could come back to us on Monday? I'd like to know, for the last 5 years, the payments from the producers to the North Slope Borough, the amounts and the purpose, please. And if the state doesn't have that, where I would write to request that information. Thank you.
Okay. Rob, moving on to page 22, line 1.
Okay. Madam Chair, this it has to do with subsection E, which is adjustments to lease expenditures. The committee will recall that in order to implement the idea of only allowing net cost to be deducted, producers are required to make adjustments to their lease expenditures when they get reimbursements and when they sell assets and so forth. And the general language that starts this is at the top of page 22. It refers to subtracting payments or credits received by the producer. The producers or the industry raised the concern about whether the term credits could be interpreted as including the tax credits that are provided for under the bill. And of course, if that were done, it would basically take away part of the benefit of the credits. That's not the intention. And so, just to, in an abundance of caution, because I don't really think that's a reasonable interpretation, but just to make it absolutely clear, the amendment proposes inserting the phrase after credits other than tax credits under this chapter.
Are there any questions on that particular? Okay, next item.
Okay. The next several that are on page 23 and 24 have to do with a concern that was raised yesterday about the non-transferable credit under section 170. The concern was, could that language be read as allowing a separate credit for up to 5,000 barrels of oil and up to 5,000 barrel equivalent of gas. And to make sure that's not possible, we're suggesting slightly changing the language here. So for example, at the bottom of page 23, lines 30 to 31, where it now reads, if the average number of barrels of oil equivalent produced during it produced the day, and then it goes on to either be 5,000 or more. We're changing that to if the average amount of oil and gas produced a day, that it's clear that it's both oil and gas. And then we're just rearranging the language about 170 to implement that change. And that takes us up to line 4 of page 4 of the amendment.
Okay. If I'm not mistaken, yesterday we amended line 3 on page 24 to read more than 5,000. Is that going to change anything?
Madam Chair, yes. I mean, this is a technical question that I may be off on, but I believe that until the new version comes out, all of the amendments
okay.
to refer to the existing CS language. But you're correct. It would actually
okay. It would read more than 5,000 barrels of oil equivalent.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you. Well, the drafters will fix that out. Okay. Thank you.
All right. The next change on page 24, line 10. When I was drafting the final part of this amendment, which has to do with gas treatment credits, and wanted to include a similar provision about non-transferability, it occurred to me that when the current section 170, page 24, line 10 says that the tax credit is not transferable under AS 4355024D. It could be read as implying that it may be transferable under some other provision, and so it seems to me to be more clear. It should just say it's not transferable, period, and that's why the proposal is to delete the reference to 024D.
Okay, so we'll just delete under 4355024D. Okay. Any questions? It's just not creditable. It's not transferable. Okay. Next item. Let's see. Now we're on page 24, 25, and 26.
Right. That's just basically okay. Clarifying. This has to do with, again, making sure that there's only a single credit for oil and gas. So it's a slightly rearranging the definition to make that more clear.
Okay.
The definition of barrel of oil equivalent.
Anyone have any questions on that? Okay, that's fine. And the last part, which goes from the middle of page 4 to all of page 5, if you could walk us through that new section, please.
Okay. Well, of course, this is the very substantive change. The committee will recall that under the revised definitions of gross value at the point of production, in the bill, the point of production for gas would be further downstream than it is under current law. Under current law, gas processing, which is the extraction of hydrocarbon liquids from gas, is downstream of the point of production. But under the bill, it would be upstream, and therefore investments in gas processing would be eligible for the usual capital credit. But gas treatment, which is basically getting gas in a condition to be shipped in a pipeline, gas treatment would still be downstream and would not be eligible for the credit. Now, it would still lead to deductions for transportation costs as under current law, but that's a different way of handling those costs. So this new section reflects a policy judgment that there should be a credit to encourage or incentivize the building of gas treatment facilities. And what this provides that for future investments in gas treatment, there'd be a 35% credit, which could be applied either against the income tax or the production tax. Now, subsection B just does the usual tweak that if a producer, in calculating the production tax, annualizes the lease expenditures, which is to say, takes the annual lease expenditures divided by 12 and uses that every month instead of using the actual month-to-month lease expenditures, that they have to do the same thing with this credit and apply a 12th of the month during the year. It has the same kinds of restrictions that the Section 170 credit does. Well, actually, with one exception, it's not transferable. That's what's stated in subsection D. However, it can be carried forward and used in later periods if it's necessary to avoid reducing the tax below zero. Now, what kinds of expenditures would qualify for the credit? Well, first of all, it has to be to acquire or construct either a new gas treatment facility or to improve a current one. And it uses the same definition of capitalized expenditure as in 024. That is, it has to be treated as a capitalized expenditure under Internal Revenue Code rules. And it also imports the concept of having to be direct, ordinary, and necessary from the existing language in for lease expenditures in Section 160. Now, one other change is made in connection with this. There's a definition in the current bill of gas treatment. That's on page 27, lines 24 through 29. And this is just to clarify that gas treatment does not include gas liquefaction, but only conditioning gas in the gaseous state for transportation through a pipeline. Now, I should mention that there actually needs to be another conforming part of the amendment that hasn't been drafted yet. It's just to deal with the fact that the first year is less than a full calendar year, so the percentages that are referred to in subsection B, when you annualize and divide by 12, you just have to divide by a fewer number of months. We have several examples of those currently toward the end of the bill, and that just has to be added. I'm going to be working on drafting that. It's just not available yet.
Okay. We can always give that instruction to the drafter as well to fractionalize the year. Senator Bundy.
Speaking of conforming, being we changed the effective date yesterday, I'm wondering if this July 1 effective date needs to be addressed as well.
What line is that?
Senator Bundy, yes, that's true. As I said before, my understanding was that since I'm making I wrote an amendment to the existing CS, I refer to the existing language, but it would be changed to conform to whatever the rest of the dates are.
Yes, sir.
Another question. Oh, thank you. Yes, the amount of 35% credit, and we've had 20% in the governor's bill and 25% in this CS, and now 35%. Do you know why that amount was chosen?
Madam Chair, Senator Bundy, that's absolutely a policy call. I was just asked to draft it this way. Dan Dickinson is the person I've been communicating with, but I really don't have firsthand knowledge about what went into that decision.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Wilkin, then Senator Shepard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask this at the end of the total amendment, but I'll ask it now because it seems most appropriate. Robin, is there any fiscal impact of this amendment, and if so, the amount? Plus or minus to the existing Senate CS?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkin, I've just very recently got this. I do not have that number. I can certainly get back to you with that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, Madam Chair. Well, this is a large policy call here today in this amendment. And particularly, in my opinion, we have understated the potential impact of the credits in the potential stimulation of the North Slope and the desirability to the producers of that particular benefit. And it's definitely the credit is going to make it more expensive for them to take their capital and leave the state. It's going to be more advantageous for them to reinvest it into the state, which is the intent, so we can expand and stem or stimulate our production that's been in decline. But in doing so, it's going to impact the PPT tax to an unknown amount, depending on their expenditures. I'm rather reluctant to allow them to take that credit against a corporate income tax without a little better understanding of what potential impacts it's going to have on the state revenue. Now, going to a 35% credit on the gas treatment, I think I could live with that, but I would like to have it treated like all other credits, limited to the PPT tax, restricting their ability to go to the corporate income tax, just in case this piece of economic stimulus that we're putting together, this tax bill, works better than some of us anticipate, which it may.
Okay, now what part are you concerned about? Direct me to it in the document.
Line 20, page 4.
Mm-hmm.
Where currently we have a 25% tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
And the credit here is going to move to 35% to help stimulate construction and upgrades of gas treatment facilities. But allowing that credit to not only go against a PPT tax, but to then allow it against the corporate income tax, I think may have a potential detrimental impact on state revenues in the event that we have, you know, a declining oil price and some large credit buildup.
Robin, do you have any response?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, it is inconsistent with the rest of the bill as far as application. I do not have the numbers as far as the potential impact on the corporate income tax at this time.
Any other? Senator Stedman.
It takes money to run the state, and we all know where it comes from. That's the North Slope. We'll have our royalties in place regardless of the amount of credits that are applied against construction of facilities in the North Slope. And we'll have our property tax. We should ensure the collection of income tax. And then we have at risk the PPT tax, which is going to be very volatile depending on market conditions, not only in price and volume, but the amount of credits being generated by the industry. And I think it's in the best interest of the state to compartmentize that into just the PPT arena. I just don't like putting our neck out all the way out on the chopping block and then have some form of a commitment for multiple years and find out it's not working as well and the inability to back up.
Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Stedman, I got the implication that you thought that the industry could go ahead and double dip against the PPT as well as the corporate income tax. But as I read this part of the amendment, it says it may not be applied against both a tax under AS 4320 and also under 4355.
Not double dipping.
Senator Stedman.
The statute appears, or the amendment appears to be clean, you can't use it twice. But once they've eradicated and or they're better off to apply it against a corporate income tax, they'll do that. I would just as soon have it compartmentalized, or if they don't use the amount of credit being generated, they can carry it forward and use it the following year, knowing that we have the corporate income tax protected from any type of development credit generation on the North Slope, because we have no idea what kind of stimulus this package is going to generate. I personally believe it's been underestimated at this table, the impact of those credits.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Hoppin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would concur with Senator Stedman on that issue.
Okay. Any other comments? I will take a brief at ease. Senator Hoppin. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would make the following conceptual amendment. On page 3, lines 14 and 15, delete in their entirety. Second part of the amendment on page 4.
Is it the amendment to the amendment?
Amendment to the amendment.
Sorry.
Yes. Thank you. This is an amendment to the amendment. On page 4, starting on line 15, all material be deleted on page 4 from line 15 to 31, and all material on page 5.
Is there objection to deleting those two sections? And we will send those for reworking. Is that fine?
Yes.
Okay. Is there... Do you maintain your objection to the amendment as amended?
Madam Chair, thank you. And I just want to ask Robin if there is any significant fiscal impact in the remaining part of the amendment, if you would please let me know. Okay? Right. And with that, I remove my objection.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd like to also add, I'd like to have her look at into the other impact on the corporate income tax, 4320 on the smaller 5,000 or 50,000 barrel a year people or exposure, just so we can get an idea of what we're facing there, because that is the only area that I recall within this bill that the corporate income tax can be impacted.
Yes.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay, with that, amended amendment number 7. Is there any objection? Amended amendment number 7 is adopted. And those two sections we've deleted, we will, while we finish our work, we can see if we can get those reworked to satisfy some of the comments we've heard here. Is there another amendment?
Madam Chair, can we take a brief at ease?
Sure.
Amendment number 8 addresses progressivity. Basically, it brings the multiplier back up to 2, starting at $50 at ANS. And it is the same as the one that was adopted in the resources version, and it takes the existing one out of the bill.
No, I object. Are there other comments? Senator Bundy.
Yes, as we've had questions on other issues, other impacts, I'm just wondering if Robin could give us a ballpark figure of the fiscal impact of this change.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, yes, I certainly can. I would have to consult with my economist on that number.
I think we have that from yesterday, don't we?
Yeah, we mm-hmm. Yeah, it was presented to us.
Yeah, we have it. Mm-hmm. The first, is it in this one?
PPC revenue studies from day before yesterday. Brief at ease, please.
So this is on the rules or anything?
On the bill.
This is
on
the rules.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yes, sir. And I'll speak to my objection because, you know, as we talked the other day when we introduced our the CS, it was an effort to come to kind of an in-between and give everybody something to like and everybody something to kind of feel uncomfortable about, and have the trigger for starting progressivity a little higher. We are currently at $70. If we have anything that begins at 40 or 50 now, we essentially can add on $6 or $8 to the tax rate, and that is what we are saying with the little adjustment is the actual tax rate. I find that a little disingenuous, and I'm very uncomfortable in doing that. If we're going to do that, let's say we're going to have a 30% tax rate and go from there. But otherwise, we need to be saying exactly what we have and presenting it as very, very factual. And the proposal brought forth has already been adjusted back 3 months. And I'm very uncomfortable in us continuing to hack away at something and increase that rate to a point where we hopefully are never sorry, but to find ourselves in a world of hurt. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was wondering if we could have the sponsor of the amendment explain this to us.
Senator Hoffman, you want to move the amendment?
I did move the amendment.
Oh, you did? Okay, thank
yes.
you.
Well, primarily, I think the chart, there's been a lot of discussion on the amendment, both in the House and in the Senate. And this is I believe in the middle, you know, mm-hmm. compared to what the House has done. This would be on the gross, and I think we will end up less in court if we set our tax on the gross. You know, there's too many calculations, and it's much. Everyone talked about having a simpler bill. This makes it much simpler to calculate, and with us going back down from the 25-20 that the governor had, this bill brings it back down to the current rate of 22.5 and increases the credits to 25. You know, I think that this to get the state's best, the fairest share, I believe, as the price of oil goes up, this proposal makes much more sense. And that is the feeling that I'm getting when I talk to the people in my district, that as the price of oil goes up, Alaska should benefit as well. You know, we're seeing $75 a barrel oil today. We've heard worldwide that Exxon has made in excess of $34 billion. You know, and we had some testimony as to what they made. We've heard that BP has had in excess of $20 billion worldwide, and that does not say what they're making in Alaska, but I think that this proposal, the oil companies will still, on their total take that you've talked about many, many times at this table, the government take would be about at $60, about 60%.
Senator Bundy.
If Robin can help us, but What was the spring forecast for oil that was just released?
When was it? The most recent one?
Yeah.
The most recent, what was the most recent oil forecast? Do you recall?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I...
From the Department of Revenue, when they do their spring?
Yes, no, I understand. I don't have those numbers with me.
Rob, do you have that?
Have it in a minute.
Are we speaking about the long-term forecast?
I think it's for the short term.
Short term.
Was it, I think it was probably just below 60. 55, 53,
54,
somewhere in there.
It was 58,
I think. 58 rings a bell with me. Yeah.
Well, and I guess going back, hearkening back to information that I keeps rattling around my brain, that the long-term forecast is about 40, though. And again, who knows? The only thing constant is about oil forecasts is they're always wrong. But if indeed it was 40, then this progressivity wouldn't have any impact at all. If it's above 50, it would. So, okay, thank you.
Okay. Did anyone else have their hand up? Senator Shemin, did you? Senator Wilken, go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'll be supporting the amendment. And we don't have the impact, but I think when we look at the government share pieces that we've been given the last few days, we're trying to seek this middle ground, and we've fallen a little bit short because of the decrease in the tax and the increase in the credit. And I'm comfortable with all these numbers. I'm comfortable with a government share of 60%. And when I look at my charts, I think just by looking at the two lines between the resource bill and the current Senate version, I think it's going to hit it just about to 60% with a very slight slope for progressivity, and I think that's where we want to be. So I'll be supporting it, but I would sure like to see this chart done again with the new piece in it. So, thank you.
Senator Shemin.
This amendment was, or this issue of progressivity is, we spent quite a bit of time on the Resources Committee, and it has evolved from a gross starting at West Texas and slowly moved to West Coast, the Los Angeles price, and then on up. I'm using wellhead along with the West Coast price, and then there was a lot of concern on the tax treatment if it should be before or after tax, and the way this is written and the way the one at the Resources Committee was written in the equation here, one minus the PPT tax gives you the effective after-tax rate. So this would be an effective after-tax, but that after the Resources Committee, we had a lot of testimony from the industry in that the impact of their rising costs do not get picked up by this equation, and the progressivity feature was moved then to before tax, on the net basis from the gross, where it is today in the bill. And then there's been considerable discussion here at this table, the pros and cons of using the net. Clearly the net will move forward in time with the cost of production and the cost of doing business in the state of Alaska. And the projections we have are for a fairly flat government take without progressivity or a slight decline. So the bill as it stands before the amendment neutralizes the leverage the industry may have over the state on advancing prices. And as you know, as the bills evolve, a lot of these issues keep coming back. So anyway, I stand and will support the current language in the bill. Thank you, Madam.
What is the impact when you subtract one minus the PPT rate, since we've adjusted the PPT rate? Does that not increase the...
Madam Chair, if I could, it decreases it effective multiplied by the tax rate. It used to be 0.25, now it's 0.225, 22.5. It just, in effect, gives it an after-tax treatment, even though they don't get a deduction like a regular business expense. Mm-hmm. The effect of a tax deduction is already factored into the formula. So this would, in effect, be an after-tax. And there was discussion earlier, several weeks ago, about a double deduction. If we had one less the tax rate, what is in here, and we allowed them to deduct it, they would deduct it twice,
mm-hmm.
or get an effect of a double deduction. But that would not be in the best interest of the state, and if the amendment does pass, we want to make sure in the language that it can't not be directly deducted, because the effect of the deduction is embedded in the formula.
The other, if this is changing our system from a gross value to a net value, is this all the language that's needed to do that?
That's my understanding. I asked it was drafted by
General. I know it was by Ledge Legal. I can't imagine that it's,
you know,
not other changes necessary.
It seems as if it's aimed at just progressivity and not the whole bill. Again,
how do you do net value? I mean, the whole reason for doing the net value, though, was to build in with progressivity the cost versus, you know, the and adjust for cost among different producers and all, and have a consistent system versus just a kind of a one size fits all. Senator Stedman, you had a response?
Because I think this appears to be the language that would be in the entirety to make the bill revert back to an earlier version, basically coming out of the resources on this issue. You did draw the point of the distinction between the two, the gross and the net. The gross meaning it is not affected by changes in costs. It ignores that, it just goes off of price. Where on the net, you have a built-in cost factors, cost increase, the trigger point moves up. On the net, you would have, over time, a moving trigger going up in price, where under the gross, it would be a stationary trigger point. What they're talking about here is $50. So that would be a point in time. Eventually, sometime in the future, maybe 10, 15, 20 years, depending on costs and expansion of the fields, the industry may want to come back and revisit it.
Senator Wilkin, you had something?
No, ma'am.
Okay, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for the amendment sponsor. It seems like there's a couple of different issues here. One in your amendment. One is to go back to the gross. The other is to address progressivity and peg it at 50 and at 0.002. As I understand the current bill, it would be pegged at an equivalent price of $60 a barrel, and the progressivity would be 0.001. Now, Senator Stedman, did I understand you to say that you preferred the progressivity of the current bill that wouldn't start until $60 a barrel and then would only be 0.001?
The trigger points of the difference between the current bill at 60 and the amendment at 50 is the spread as we stand here today. And yes, I do not support the amendment as presented.
And if I might, is concerned the gross or the change in the progressivity, or it's the combination?
Well, I think it's a net effect of the entire package we're working with. This is one, if I could, Madam Chairman, this is one piece of the pie. And we're trying to assemble everything and get a snapshot view of what we're baking as we bake the cake, so to speak.
Yeah, if I might, one more thing. And then Senator Hoffman, it appears to me, like I said, there's two issues, progressivity and then changing the whole system back to gross again. Had you considered dividing the amendment?
Well, I think that it's divisible, and if that's what the committee wants to do, I don't have any problem with that, Madam Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Stedman, as we look at this very complicated bill here, you know, the whole concept of progressivity is a fairly almost another dimension of consideration. Is it not made, just correct me if I'm wrong, is it not made simpler by going to the gross as opposed to the net for the determination of the final bottom number that the state gets?
Senator Stedman.
It's my understanding that going to the gross would be a simpler and a system that would be less likely to be manipulated. But there's pros and cons of each one. The net appears to be more complex. But with the net, we've got to remember the calculation of taking into account the expenses already done anyway to get to the PPT tax. And the net would be before the PPT tax is applied. And you could not use your credits to dilute the dollar amount, you know, of the net.
So, Madam Chairman, just for clarification again, the effect of the amendment of going to the gross would make this complicated bill less complicated. That was a yes or no question, really. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
I think the still and the net value, it still addresses the problem of the cost. As costs increase, and even though the price of the barrel goes up, if the cost have increased exponentially or more than, it gives a fairer assessment of what we should be taxing, and that's built in without having to go back to the drawing board and saying, and when we actually do better.
The production cost you're talking about. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Anyone else? We're going to take a brief at ease, please. Robin, could you talk to us a little bit about the progressivity and regressivity on this amendment, perhaps, as compared to what the current version does?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And again, for the record, my name is Robin Wilson, Tax Director.
Robin, could you put the microphone a little closer to your face, please? Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Is that better?
That's much better.
Okay. Yes, what I wanted to talk about for a minute is the idea of progressivity based on net has several advantages. One is that it takes into account costs. And so to the extent that oil is more difficult to get out of the ground, such as heavy oil, then it sort of naturally accounts for that. Whereas if you have progressivity based on gross, it does not take into account costs or increased costs. So the net is, I think, a better plan as it is in the current bill, just on its face. It is progressive, I mean, clearly. And that takes care of regressivity in the long run. I wanted to talk for a moment about what does progressivity mean. In its purest sort of technical sense, it means that the tax rate goes up based on what is measured. And so if we think about our personal income tax returns, what is measured is our net taxable income. And as that goes up, then the federal government has set up sort of a stair-step system so that you pay a higher tax when you're making more money. And so the net approach to progressivity honors that idea of progressivity because you are measuring, this overall bill measures tax based on net value, that is after costs. And so from that standpoint, then a progressivity piece that increases based on the net is consistent, is internally consistent. If it's on gross, it sort of takes it has a disconnect there, if you will. We're measuring net, and yet we have this piece that's on gross. The other thing I wanted to touch on for a moment is there have been comments over the last, I don't know, several weeks about net calculation being more difficult. I think the way it's crafted in the current bill, it is not difficult because the way it works is you figure out what the net value is that will be taxed overall, and you divide that by the number of barrels. So what you end up with there, theoretically, is a net value per barrel. And so then you look at that and say, is it over the trigger point, which in the bill I believe is 45, and to the extent that it is over that trigger, then the progressivity is calculated on that. So I do not see this as a particularly troublesome calculation. It has nothing to do with the credits. If we think back again to a personal income tax return, you know, you start with your gross wages and you have certain deductions, charitable contributions and whatnot. You get to a taxable income, and that's what you measure your tax on. And then after you figure out your tax, then you may apply certain credits such as education credit, perhaps child care credit. But that's basically how do you pay for your tax. And so this approach to progressivity then basically stops it at the taxable measure, which is net value. You don't mix up application of credits in this at all. So I see this as a very straightforward calculation and very readable and understandable. And I know that over the last several weeks, we've seen many variations of progressivity. You know, with all due respect, I would suggest that the calculation in the amendment is a little awkward. It gets to cents or dollars per barrel. It is workable. I'm not saying there's a technical flaw in the calculation. But in terms of understandability and consistency with the idea of taxing on net, I would suggest that what is in the current bill is preferable.
Thank you. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think the net may be a little more complex than the gross, but there's nothing simple about this bill. And I do support the notion of the adjustment that the nest makes for increased costs as we look out into the future. I don't, however, look at progressivity quite like I do a progressive income tax. When oil is 70 and maybe $80 a barrel, I look more at progressivity in this bill as a windfall tax. Now, it may not technically meet those definitions, but that's man on the street kind of definition, I think. And so, Madam Chair, I would like to move to divide the amendment where we would have a vote on whether we go to the gross calculation and then a vote on whether we would change the progressivity factor in the current bill to a level similar to that's in this amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
I don't believe the amendment is divisible. I think the proper procedure would be to vote on this, and if that didn't happen, then Senator Bundy could move his amendment to change the current legislation to 0.2 or 0.3.
Another number, okay.
But in speaking to the, back to the issue at hand, Madam Chair, I think that we had discussed different ways to address progressivity, and probably the best one that was discussed hasn't been considered, and that was looking at the governor's original 2020 plan and have it stair step with dollars. You know, start possibly at 15, 20, at $30, and these are just numbers I'm throwing out. 2020 at $35, 2520 at $40, and 3020 at even a higher number, and that would probably, depending on the dollars attached, would give us a straighter line. So there are different ways to address progressivity, but we did not look at those, and all of the committees looked at progressivity on the gross, and it wasn't until the CS came out that another option was considered. And all along the dialogue has been to see what we could do to simplify this legislation, and I think that the resolution is can be calculated, and as was testified, and I think that it works.
Are there other comments? Senator Bundy.
If there's the view that the amendment is not divisible, I would withdraw my motion.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, I will maintain my objection to this amendment, and in certainly in light of what Robin has said, that this what we have currently is workable, and that going back to this is not preferable. Roll call, please.
No.
Senator Olson?
Let me pass on this one.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
No.
Senator Bison?
Yes.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Green?
No.
Four yeas,
three nays. So Amendment 8 is passed. Is adopted. Okay, any other comments? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple days ago, we asked for some information from our consultant, Econ One, and that came in last night, and I think everybody has two sheets of paper. Effective average tax rates for various price levels and effective average tax rates for various price levels in regard to government share. So I passed that out, and I think we put it out on the table for others. So that's just for the committee's information. Also, Madam Chair, I have at least one and perhaps two more amendments coming, and we're waiting on the drafter, so I can check and see where they are in their work. If you'd like me to do that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Tyson?
I have one amendment that's ready to go, I think, if you want to deal with that while we're waiting.
Okay, well, as I said yesterday, that these amendments were due yesterday. And out of respect to you, I will entertain them, but I'm very disappointed that they were not here yesterday. Senator Stedman?
Madam Chair, on another note.
Yes, sir.
Lunch is approaching.
Too bad. We've got people waiting in this room for the next bills. We will not be recessing. Senator Bat Dyson.
Yeah, I have an amendment. I don't know what number it is, but probably being passed out now.
Brief at ease while this is being passed.
Senator Bundy. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment 10.
Checked. For explanation?
Yeah, thank you. Oh, and at some point, I may ask you to allow Senator Wagner to help me answer questions on it, but the net effect of this is to reduce the tax rate on the oil portion on Cook Inlet. Mm-hmm. It's a very challenged area with a 90% water cut, and it's certainly those of us who live in the Cook Inlet area realize that keeping the industry going there, and particularly gas production, is very important, and probably for we've got to do everything we can for 10 years until we have a gas spur line down to the area. So that's what this intent is. It reflects language that had been discussed in earlier versions.
Are there any questions of the sponsor? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This issue has been discussed several times. And just for the record, I'm just wondering if we couldn't get the royalty estimate for Cook Inlet in not so much in dollars, but in percentage terms. And then also, as mentioned earlier, there's a what Senator Dyson referred to as a cut. My understanding is they're pumping a lot more water than oil. And if we could have a little bit of an explanation of the intricacies of Cook Inlet for the record.
I think we already have that. Okay. Somewhere in some of the documents we have. And can't put my fingers on it right now, but I'm sure that in some of this.
I believe it's in the resources, CS.
No, I'm talking about the pamphlets they handed out. On the total oil for Cook Inlet barrels per day, 19,000 barrels of oil equivalent. Oh, that's not listed. You're talking about less than total of 20,000 barrels a day. As this says, unless someone got updated information.
Madam Chairman, if I could, we've got a lot of moving parts in this bill, and one of the moving parts that I think we pretty much got nailed down, and that's the barrel exclusion, which would Cook Inlet would qualify for. Mm-hmm. I think most of the production in Cook Inlet would qualify for that. And there's a couple of other producers within there that don't because of volume. Above the 5,000 barrels. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be nice if we did have, especially for people at home that are listening and watching, a little brief explanation of what that barrel exclusion, how it applies to Cook Inlet, and address the potential need for royalty reduction. And in the event that this amendment doesn't pass, my understanding, it's kind of a different subject, but my understanding is that this law would be a general law of application in Cook Inlet, and we could change it in a year or 5 years or 10 years and respond to potential shutdown in Cook Inlet, because we do not want to shut down Cook Inlet. We actually want it to expand in production along with other areas. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions of the sponsor? I maintain my objection. Senator Dyson, do you have anything further? Okay, thank you. Roll call, please.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Stedman?
No.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Wilson?
Yes.
Senator Green?
No.
5-8, 2-0.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Brief at ease, please.
Brief at ease. And here, House Bill 357. We have some folks here who've been waiting quite some time.
Thank you, Robin. Go enjoy this marvelous weather. Well, you can tell them whenever they're ready to sit. Don't rush up to you because.
Go right ahead.
I'm Peggy Wilson, and I'm from District 2, and I'm going to turn over the explanation of this bill to my intern, Aaron Robertson.
Aaron?
This is Representative Wilson. My name's Aaron Danielson, and 357 is statutory references to disabilities. This bill was at the request of the Department of Labor and also the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education and a part in this. And this bill is pretty simple. What it does is that it goes through Alaska's statutes and changes all references to handicap and changes that to person or peoples with disabilities. And this is, you know, in response to the change of language over the years. This was originally a piece of federal legislation called the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, which changed federal statutes also through this language, as well as a number of other changes I'm sure many of you are aware of. The states have slowly been getting around to changing this. The most recent one was in Minnesota last spring in 2005. I included a copy of their legislation in your packets as well. And this is really important distinction between, referring to people with handicapped or changing that to say persons with disabilities. A handicap is more of an environmental limitation. If there's somebody is in a wheelchair and they're confronted with a set of stairs, then they are handicapped by that, but they are not a handicapped person. There's a person with a disability, and this is a really important language change for their community that they do feel really strongly about, and people do feel really strong about this outside their community as well. And besides that, if there's any questions you have.
Does this contain language about the signage?
This does not contain any language about signage. Representative Stoltz had concerns about that in the House Finance Committee, and it doesn't require any change of signage.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? I actually thought we had done this when I was on the Governor's Council, because I remember going through statutes line after line, and there were obviously some that were overlooked, or this is a different section of law. Maybe. I bet that's what it is. I bet it's a different section. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And with the zero fiscal notes, then I would assume that signs that say handicapped parking as they become deteriorated will be replaced with a more appropriate label.
Lingo, yeah. Reference. Are there any other questions?
Thank you. I know we have two people here to testify, and Kevin has certainly waited very patiently, and I wanted to be sure he did not have to continue to wait. So, Kevin, you want to join us and give your testimony, please?
Sure. Can you hear me from here?
Yes, you're fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Kevin Gadsby. I work for Southeast Alaska Independent Living. Thank you. As an independent living specialist. And we also do advocacy work for persons with disabilities on a systems level and individual level. It's been a discussion and a process for our community as well over the past 20, 30 years to find out what words work best for us and what we prefer to be called. And we found that it is persons with disabilities that is best, because handicap is a word that is considered by some an annoyance, by others a slur, as awful as a certain language used to describe other cultures that I won't repeat here on the record. And I really just want to stress that this is very important to us, because the state law guides the language that the rest of the world, the rest of Alaska will follow. And it's important for it to be changed. We appreciate all that you have done. And in answer to your question about about the parking signs, there's still a lot of use of handicap parking, and we are slowly working to have that changed also. It's more or less working with the private businesses who make those signs to get them to understand it's just about the symbol of the wheelchair or accessible parking.
Sure. Thank you very much. Any questions of Kevin? Thank you for coming, and thank you. And sorry you had to wait.
Not a problem at all.
For this to come up. Paula Scavero?
Thank you.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Paula Scavero. I'm Special Assistant to the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Education. Department of Labor and Workforce Development. This bill contains change languages in health and social services, transportation, education, commerce, and law and administration. So it's not just a verbiage change in labor's. I'm going to give you a little history lesson. I'm kind of a history buff. The word handicap was a word that was first used in Great Britain after the Crimean War. Parliament made it legal for war veterans to beg on the streets, and if they had a cap handy. So that's where the word handicap comes from. It was for war veterans to be able to legally beg. Well, as you know, we do not treat our people with disabilities beggars, and this is a very important piece of legislation for them.
Thank you very much. Any questions of Paula? Thank you very much. I doubt that anyone has any questions or concerns with this legislation, and I would assume there's no reason to hold this. Does anyone want to review any further? Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, I move to report House Bill 357 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Oh, and we need to, there is also a letter intent, if you'd like to look that over very closely. But is there any objection to adopting House Bill 357? And House Bill 357 is adopted, and we want to...
Madam Chair, move the letter of intent.
Is there objection to the letter of intent? The letter of intent is also adopted. Thank you very much. Moves from committee with individual recommendation and accompanying zero fiscal notes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. House Bill 394. Everyone wants to come up and testify today. I can tell all the suits are here.
All right. Saturday's a good day.
Okay, welcome, Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Senate Finance Committee. It's good to be here today. Before you is House Bill 394, and it has to do with the foreign language. The latest consensus shows that over 80,000 Alaskans speak a different language than English. And though these same Alaskans have to purchase insurance, there's an obstacle in our state law to a company publishing a policy or advertising in another language other than English. And since the law is silent on which version or policy is the official version, and since insurance companies are interpreted against the insurance, since insurance policies are interpreted against the insurance company with all the associated material that is provided and considered, and since no translation is perfect when you go from English to a different a language, and any translation is easily challengeable in court. Insurance companies in general are fairly conservative, and they're reluctant to publish pamphlets or policies in any other language other than English. What this bill does is removes that obstacle and allows companies to publish and advertise their materials in another language other than English. The key point here, though, is that as long as the English language is the official version and the one that's registered with the Division of Insurance. Madam Chair, insurance policies are tough enough to understand in our own language, let alone in a language that's foreign to you. So what this allows is opens the doors for insurance companies to serve a growing market in Alaska, but yet clarifies the responsibilities of the companies to protect the consumer. Madam Chair, House Bill 394 is a relatively simple bill, but will do a lot for various groups in the state of Alaska and for insurance companies to try to provide a service to them. And we're available for any questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Come on. Senator Bundy, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just the observation that I made in Labor and Commerce that I think insurance policies in many cases are already written in a foreign language, so perhaps we're overdue on this.
Yeah. Well, I will announce that my husband has an insurance office and will declare a conflict. And he has on staff a woman who is English. Actually, Spanish is her primary language, English her second language, and then she speaks another foreign language as well. And they have had an absolute influx of people to that office because of the access to an explanation in the home language of many, many, many people. And it's been a good lesson in that office, but this would certainly go a long way in helping those people and then having a document they can read and keep and understand. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I own part of a insurance agency, and one of the employees' first language is Filipino, just for the record. I'm in support of this bill. I think it would make it easier for people mm-hmm. that come into the state with a different language other than English mm-hmm. to try to comprehend and understand this complicated laws that we face in insurance. Thank you. Yeah.
And I think it's the other thing that's important is that the last of this, for purposes of this section, associated material means advertising, marketing information, brochures, pamphlets, electronic medium used to describe. And I think that's an important piece, too. So any questions? Oh, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Meyer, if I'm the local State Farm agent, what does this mean to me and my business? What do I have to do with this new legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, we actually do have a State Farm agent who I think wants to testify on this and give you, you know, the exact answer. But what this does, my understanding, what this does now is makes it official that the policy can now be written in Spanish or I know there's all sorts of native languages, but with the understanding that the official language that they're going to give to the Division of Insurance is going to be English, and that they've interpreted and translated the best that they could. I'm going to ask my staff to help me out on this. It's been a while since this bill's come up.
For the record, Madam Chairman, my name is Michael Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. And through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I think the point you're asking, and this would be my inference, is that the bill doesn't require anyone in the private sector to conduct themselves or do their business in any way, shape, or form. What it does is rather remove an obstacle to the conduct that they would like to have from statute. So there's not a requirement on private industry to conduct business in a certain way. It just allows the free market to work.
So under current law, you're not able to produce the insurance policy in Russian or Japanese?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, it's not that you're not able to produce the policy. It's that because insurance contracts are contracts of adhesion and interpreted against the insurance company, you're reluctant to. Since there is no definition of which might be the official version, it's like having two different committee substitutes. If you don't agree which one's adopted, you can't go forward from there. And so a company, because of that mess, is reluctant to conduct a business practice that they would like to. And so it's that gray area in statute that we're trying to clean up.
So the legislation allows a company that today can't do that to produce a policy in a foreign language, and that becomes the official policy.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, the policy that they produce in a foreign language would be for informational purposes only. That would be disclosed to the person, and then the English version would be the official version as far as the state and the courts and everything else is concerned.
Oh, okay, that helps. Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah. Are there any other questions of the sponsor or Michael Pawlowski? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. So just to make sure I've got it straight, let's say that we've got a policy that's written in English and a policy that's written in Spanish, and because of the different dialects of Spanish from either, and somebody from Spain versus somebody from Uruguay looks at the Spanish and either has his own difficulty and has his own interpretation of it, if there's a challenge to the, or if there's a claim filed and there's a challenge and the Spanish fellow says, you know, see, the inference I get from this policy is I'm covered, and the agent says, well, I don't speak Spanish, but this is my English policy, therefore we're going to do it under the mandate of the English, which becomes the, and the judge looks at it, let's say he's down in Texas, what's he going to say?
Go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator Olson. The English version would always be the official version, according to the law. And the key being, and I believe that the representatives from industry and the Division of Insurance will speak to this, that the version in another language other than English is purely for informational purposes. And the key parts of the bill being that you cannot misrepresent anything in another language. That's the consumer protection side of it. But you want to give them both, and it's for informational purposes only.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions of the sponsor or Michael? Okay, thank you. We have two people in the room to testify. Jeff Trout. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Trout. I am the Deputy Director of the Division of Insurance, and I'm speaking in support of the bill. Most of what I was going to say was said by Representative Meyer, and probably more eloquently than I could. So I will limit what I have to say, lest I snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. But I would like to address a couple of issues. One is we see this as a consumer protection bill. Anything that helps educate people about the insurance process, what their policy says, what it does, what it doesn't do. It's good for the consumers, and you know, some people might say, well, you're in America, you need to speak English. But you know, the fact is, if you're a first generation immigrant, you know, you're very unlikely to ever learn English to the degree, to the proficiency that's required. I have two law degrees. I have trouble understanding them, so it can be fairly tough. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things that Senator Wilkins had asked. There's no law or regulation that affects how we do how we deal with foreign language bills. I mean, we have on a couple of occasions we've received Spanish language policies, health insurance policies, as I recall. And we sort of have to wing it because there's no law or regulations. You know, we've accepted them. We've accepted them, and as long as they had an English translation, because there's only one person that can in the division that can understand, you know, that probably could be able to translate it fairly well. But in terms of the effect it's going to have on your average agent, I think that's nominal. The bill's really directed towards the insurance companies, the policies they can produce and make available, both as substantive contracts and informational copies, as well as associated materials, brochures, and things like that explain the policy. And, you know, frankly, those are probably more important than the actual translation of the policy in a lot of ways in terms of helping the consumer understand it. So the effect, other than requiring them to give both an English and non-English version, the effect, I think, on your agency is going to be nominal or nil. And they, in fact, they would be able to choose whether they wanted to, you know, whether they wanted to work with people in those languages or not. And I'm done.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Mr. Trout. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Sheldon Winters.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Sheldon Winters. I represent State Farm. We support this bill. We'd like to thank the sponsor and also Senator Huggins, who sponsored the companion bill in this chamber at Senate Bill 280. Industry supports this bill. Division supports the bill. We simply want to be able to provide good information to these non-English speaking people. It's good for the industry. It's good for the consumer. And it's the growing trend, and we find that in those states that have similar laws, there is a vast amount of information going out in non-English policies and brochures, and I think you'll see that here in Alaska as well. I can answer some questions. I think they've been answered, but I'll leave it at that, and thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Winters? Thank you for being here with us today on a beautiful Saturday. Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions that anyone might have about this legislation? Senator Wilkins.
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 394 from 394 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Yes, 394 is on its way with attached recommendation and company fiscal note. Thank you. Okay. House Bill 400. And then we'll move right to 408.
Good morning. My name is Karen Litzter, and I am staff to Representative Coghill. He was called
away. Would you pull the microphone just a little closer to you, please?
He was called away and is sorry that he isn't here to present this bill. So I will do my best to give you the information regarding House Bill 400. And basically what we're looking at here is some of the information that we saw that happened after the devastation in New Orleans of Katrina, and when protection of the law-abiding citizen was removed when the firearms were confiscated. We looked at the Alaska Disasters Act that has some limitations in there, and we added in one more that says there is no authority granted to confiscate lawfully owned, possessed, or carried firearms by law-abiding citizens. When the bill was first introduced, it had established a penalty for that as a Class A felony. As it went through the committee process, that was reduced and has been clarified and brought to you in the bill that you have before you, where it has the sidebars put in that we need to make sure that a person that would be in a situation to possibly lose their position has in fact been found guilty of an official misconduct under Alaska Statute 1156-850 or interference with constitutional rights under the Alaska Statute 1176-110. When we spoke with a number of individuals in public safety, they believe that it was also appropriate to have an appointed government position. If you have your police officers and those types of personnel that fall under the jurisdiction of the Alaska Police Standards Council, they also would be subject to review and possible revocation of their police certification. So the bill before you just puts an opportunity to make sure that when the citizens in Alaska during a disaster are in their greatest need, that they are not their own ability to protect themselves with firearms is not taken away from them.
Other questions? Senator Bundy.
Madam Chair, looking at the list of co-sponsors from the other body, I'm tempted to ask to hold the bill for a while to see if I could fit Senate Bill 141 under the title, but
okay.
Perhaps I'll that just reconsider that.
Yes.
Oh my goodness, we have. Well, I have to say, I don't understand. This is not what I thought it was. I read it wrong, I think. Does anyone have any questions? Please, someone have a question, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Is there anybody that's opposing this bill?
I have not had any communications or emails, and it did pass unanimously on the House side. So, no, sir. Through the chair. Excuse me, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Briefities, please. And I thought, my goodness, this doesn't sound like a John Coghill. Okay, are there any questions? And this simply says that someone who is in an official capacity and attempts to confiscate or can be convicted.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And forfeits any appointed government position, is subject to impeachment. Public office declared vacant. Okay, are there any questions? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, not a question, but just a comment. It appears to me this is pretty well thought out. This appears in the section of the code that talks about the declaration of disasters, and that the section 2623-200 is a pretty careful enunciation of the limits of a declaration of disaster, and it keeps government from restricting people from working out labor disputes, government from restricting freedom of speech and publication, and with this bill here also stops a declaration of a disaster from being abused by restricting people's right to keep their own legal firearms. And I guess I appreciate that this was carefully done and it appears appropriately.
Are there any other questions? Is there any need to hold this bill over, or shall we pass it right on out? Senator Bundy, you look like you're ready to do this.
Madam Chair, in spite of my interest in creative legislation, I would move that we pass out Senate Bill Committee House Substitute bill. For Committee Substitute for House Bill 400 with zero fiscal notes and individual recommendations, and the hopes that we never need it in Alaska.
Thank you. Absolutely. Is there objection? House Bill 400 passes.
Thank you very much.
Recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
House Bill 408. Reneva, do we have one amendment or two? Two. Okay, I have one here. Do we have two amendments over there?
Could we have an at ease, please?
Yes, at ease, please. We're all in our places. And who's going to be presenting today? Reneva or Tammy?
Madam Chair, my name is Reneva Moss, legislative aide for Representative Coghill. And to my right is Tammy Sandoval, Deputy Commissioner of Department of Health and Social Services, and she is the top dog at OCS. And I must say that Representative Coghill and I are very pleased with some of the changes that she's brought around in the last year and her implementation of House Bill 53. However, with the implementation of 53, we have found certain disagreements with the Attorney General's office. We found a few things that we missed. We have a new federal law that we have to come into compliance with. So with the permission of the administration, Representative Coghill has kidnapped this piece of legislation, and we've put key language in there from Representative Coghill, Representative Chenault, Representative Roekberg, and Representative Newman and McGuire. So it's Mulligan Stew again. So I'll go through it section by section. Section 1 and Section 2 have actually increased standards for providing family support services or for OCS denying the use or the responsibility for providing family support services because it has been shown by clear and convincing evidence that such services would not make a difference for the parent. Such cases would be a parent who had been convicted of murder. Just cases where it's hopeless and they need to go on and find a better placement, either with a family member, the other parent, or eventually, as a last resort, a foster home. Section 3 is just a cleanup for Section 1 and Section 2. Section 4 is language that Representative Chenault requested, and that would be that once a public official or employee of a public official requests information, the department has 5 working days to do that. And the department says they can work with this with their new computer system. It is easier to track information in a shorter period of time. This clarifies a disagreement that we had with Department of Law. It clarifies that once a report of harm has resulted in a parent making public disclosure of the perpetrator being charged with a crime, or there has been a fatality or near fatality of a child, OCS is able to disclose the nature and validity of any report of harm about any child in a report of harm in that family. All of you are familiar with the Mat-Su Valley case where information was not disclosed. It was not the fault of OCS that language was not disclosed. It was because Department of Law said you can't because of the way House Bill 53 was written. So we want to eliminate any restriction to OCS being able to respond to an allegation of them not handling the case properly. Section 6 broadens the ability to discuss, again, any report of harm pertaining to not only a child of the family, but also a child who may be under the care of that family, or a perpetrator who's been a report of harm. Section 7 is actually language that deals with a case in Fairbanks last year. Two non-related foster children were placed in a foster home. The foster parents were given legal guardianship to the children, and because of the way the laws are now, their dividends that were placed in trust were released to the legal guardians. The placement didn't work out. The children were removed from the home, but their permanent fund dividends are gone. This says that only in certain cases can the dividends be taken out of that trust. One would be that the children were placed back in legal custody of their parents. Their parents could recover the dividends. The other would be, once the child ages out and turns 18, the dividends would be released to him or her. Or if there was extenuating circumstances where, adoptive parents after a trial period of a year could recover the dividends. The reason we put the year in is because Alaska has a high rate of adoptions that do not succeed. So we want to make sure that that trial period has gone through 1 year before the dividends could be released. The fourth provision would provide that a legal guardian, if they really had circumstances that merited them having access to the dividends, they could go to court and a judge could order them to be released. Madam Chair, Section 8 deals with some federal requirements, and this will be one of the amendments. Under Section 8, practitioners of healing arts who are involved in the delivery of a child, if they see evidence of physical or mental symptoms of withdrawals from cocaine, for instance, alcohol exposure, they're required to report that to OCS as child abuse. The amendment that we will be proposing removes the words child and replaces it with the words that are in the federal statute, which says infant, so that we don't have language in there that one of the concerns of the Ombudsman's Office would be a physician who delivered a child, saw that child when he was 16 years of age drinking alcohol, would he be required to report that as child abuse? So we're trying to clean up that language and make it clear that this is for delivery, and Tammy will discuss that a little more. Section 9 is legislation that was proposed by Representative Newman that basically says that social worker training must include constitutional and statutory rights of children and families, and requires OCS to cooperate with law enforcement to ensure that the potential of criminal charges is enhanced to the best possibility so that any evidence isn't compromised. Section 10 is court rules that apply to Sections 1 and 2. Section 11, it just clarifies that the clear and convincing applies to cases that are pending cases and non-pending cases within the statute of limitations. Section 12, addresses indirect court rules and basically states that the court rule change for Sections 1, 2, and 3 would have to receive two-thirds vote in order for them to go into effect, and this bill has an immediate effective date.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Seven.
I have a question on Section 7. Section 7 on page 5 refers to the permanent fund dividend, and my understanding of the process is that those proceeds are, or the dividend is the ownership of the child and the guardian in this case that was referenced. Does not the child, when he or she becomes of age of 18, have some legal recourse against the use of the dividend? Or the basically removal of the dividend from the child's ownership?
I don't think that's been determined yet. I know that the Attorney General's office is investigating this case in Fairbanks, but I'm not sure. Unless Tammy has an answer, I don't have an answer because they are investigating it. So it's not cut and dried.
Senator Stebbins.
I could, Madam Chair. I think it's one thing when a parent or parents use a child's dividend to buy groceries and make a house payment, keep them sheltered and clothed and fed. It's a whole other ballgame when a parent uses a child's dividend for unnecessarily needed items. Anyway, I guess that is yet to be flushed through the courts in the state, but I'm sure that's coming. That's not a lone case.
Are you talking about in the circumstance of an adopted or foster child?
Correct, and referring here in the bill, Madam Chairman, where apparently this child was in temporary care long enough, I guess, to lose whatever amount of dividends were compiled. That's certainly not the intent of society to have that stuff go on.
Well, would we not then hold the natural parent to the same standard?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
We certainly don't do that.
That has yet to be determined. There is many children now that are coming of age that are looking around and wondering where their 18 dividends are. And again, there's one issue where you need to clothe and feed and house them. It's a whole other issue when you want to take the money and go to Vegas. And I think the courts are going to have something to say about that, and the sooner the better. And I do support the language in this bill, by the way.
You do what?
Do support the language.
Okay,
in the bill.
Thank you very much. We have, I know, two people. Are there any questions, any further questions? But my plan is to take the testimony of the other two people we have in the room and delay the work on the amendments, because I understand there's another amendment coming from Representative Chenault.
Madam Chair, no, there isn't. What you may have heard me refer to is language in this existing bill that was language that Representative Chenault wanted in it.
Well, apparently, we'll sort that out Monday when we hear the bill again.
Okay.
But anyway, we will hold it over until Monday after we get the testimony, and then we'll take up the amendments on
Thank
Monday
you.
As well. Beverly Smith, welcome.
My name is Beverly Smith, and I am the Christian Science Committee on Publication for the State of Alaska. And you should have in your packets something that looks similar to this. I gave it to Senator Green's office yesterday, and it was put in, I think, or maybe not.
I see.
Yes. All right. I'm not going to read it all to you, but I just want to highlight a couple of points. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today on HB 408. And just to let you know what I do is that one of my roles is to watch for any legislative proposals to ensure that Alaskans have the choice to pursue spiritual means for the prevention and cure of disease, including Christian Science treatment and care, and that Christian Science practitioners have the freedom to practice spiritual healing for the betterment of humanity. And we are proposing an amendment to 408 in Section 8 of this bill, and we would like to add a new subsection C, which would read, duties of practitioners of the healing arts, and then Part C would be, nothing in this chapter shall compel a religious healing practitioner to disclose information learned through sacred communications with a person seeking his or her spiritual help and enjoined to be kept confidential under the discipline of his or her church or religious organization. And I just want to highlight a couple of things. Under Title 47, Chapter 17, there is a definition of practitioners of the healing arts. Among the many professions listed are religious healing practitioners. So this amendment would allow Christian Science practitioners to maintain their practice according to the guidelines of their church. And on the second page of this memo that I just had distributed, in the middle of the page in italics, there is a reference to the relationship between practitioners and patients that's in the church manual of the Christian Science Church. And that their communications are in sacred confidence and private. communication between a practitioner and patient is confidential, just as it is for members of the clergy. If an individual or a family were to come to a Christian Science practitioner for healing and comfort, they should be able to expect the same environment of trust and confidentiality as they would have if they came to a Baptist minister for spiritual counseling or a priest. And then secondly, by accepting this amendment, there would be no fear for the safety of the children because any practitioner would report if a child were, in fact, in danger. Practitioners devote their full time to spiritual healing because they love mankind and have seen the efficacy of spiritual treatment in healing all kinds of conditions, including causes and effects of abuse. I might also add that I was pleased to hear that there will be an amendment forthcoming changing the word child to infant in Section 8 because that was a concern we had because of a teenage child that might come to a practitioner and want to discuss something with him or her. So that's about it. I can answer any questions. The other person that had put her name down was a Christian Science practitioner, and she had accompanied me to this hearing to be able to answer questions, but she had other obligations, so had to leave. But I can try to answer questions regarding this if anyone has one.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Bundy, and then Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding this proposed amendment, and the other that would require a doctor to notify if a baby was delivered with, obviously, drug dependent. If someone chose to go to a practitioner with an infant who was obviously drug dependent, would this amendment you're asking for preclude that practitioner from notifying the authorities that that child was in danger because of their dependency?
No, I think that if in the practitioners that I have spoken with since I've read this, their main concern was for the safety of the child and the best interest of the child. And they would say that if in a situation that where they, I mean, it would have to be their judgment, but I would trust, and there's nothing in the church that said they couldn't if the child was in danger.
But the language in the bill covers that, I think, and says that
it does, and that's why I was thinking with the sense of infant, it might make things better, because with a child, I was thinking, what if a family were to come to a practitioner, the family has alcohol problems, therefore the child has suffered because of that, not because they were necessarily affected prior to birth. But so there's a little difference in that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I might go just a little further. Well, this says the practitioner cannot be compelled. So as you said, they get to use their judgment as to whether they this is a circumstance that should be reported to authorities. But the doctor infant amendment says the doctor shall report. Is that the case?
In the bill currently, it says a practitioner of the healing arts involved in the delivery or care of a child who the practitioner determines has been adversely affected by or is withdrawing from exposure to a controlled substance or alcohol shall immediately notify the nearest office of the Department of the Child's Condition. And I think this requested amendment has more to do with something learned in conversation with a family. Mm-hmm. And the language they're requesting, and it would be more like that of the confidentiality, in a psychologist or psychiatrist's office, it would be patient client privilege and or doctor client privilege, and in this, it would just be the healing arts practitioner and the people they're talking to, their clients, would be under that same. Confidential.
Thank you.
That's my interpretation. I may be dead wrong. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. In your suggested amendment, what does sacred communication mean? What's the modifier sacred mean?
I believe because a Christian Science practitioner is technically not a member of the clergy but acts in that manner, we'd like to see it be their communication with a patient, someone that comes to them for spiritual healing, counsel, comfort, that should be considered in the same manner as the communication between a member of the clergy and a parishioner.
Yeah, thank you. And Madam Chair, and I wondered if you were thinking of it as almost synonymous with the word confidential. And so I appreciate that. We have struggled with who to make mandatory reporters, and we have made all members of the medical community mandatory reporters, and we have not made people in the religious community mandatory reporters, and that I think is a purposeful decision, perhaps not the correct one, but it's a deliberative one. And so you guys kind of straddling both things there.
Exactly. And, exactly. That's right. And I realized that in the previous session, I did look up a former bill that proposed legislation that never made it through, House Bill 92, that was trying to juggle that and solve that problem. But I wanted to make sure that the members of the committee were aware that this is a disconnect here, that I'd like to see the law rectified. And whether we do it in this bill or something else, but this would satisfy in this particular bill that's before us, that's all.
Is there any other comment? Thank you very much for joining us today. And Tammy Sandoval.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Basically, Reneva covered all of the sections. I just want to highlight that the original intent of House Bill 408 was a governor's bill meant to come into compliance with federal law, that being CAPTA, the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act. And specifically, how it began is all about substance-exposed newborns. And that's really the intent of that section, is the delivery of a child, that whomever delivers the child, if they believe that the infant is born substance-exposed, that they make a report. And I guess I would just like to say that making a report does not mean that we're going to go out and remove the child from the home if he or she is substance exposed. It obligates us to do an assessment and no more. And so I just wanted to make sure to get that on the record. And I know I just want to make comment that Jan Rutherdell from the Attorney General's office is also available to answer any questions with regard to sections 1, 2, and 3.
Are there any questions of Tammy or of the Department of Law rep online? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we will revisit this next week. And for now, we are in recess. And after we worked on amendment number 7 earlier, amended amendment number 7, we found that we had left a section in that also needs to be removed. So Senator Wilkin is going to move that we rescind our action on adopted amended amendment number 7.
Madam Chair, I would move and ask unanimous consent that the committee rescind its action on adopting amended amendment number 7.
Is there objection to rescinding our action on amended amendment number 7? We have amended amendment number 7 back before us. Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, I would move that we have a conceptual amendment to amend amendment number 7 and object for clarification. The change would be starting on page 2, line 25, through page 3, line 10, to delete those lines in their entirety.
Is there objection?
He already objected.
And I'll remove my objection. Thank you.
You remove your objection. Is there further objection?
No.
Okay, so...
Madam Chair.
Amendment number seven passes. Amended. Did we do that correctly?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Wilkins.
Madam Chair, I would move amendment number 11.
Object for discussion?
Yes, ma'am. This is some language having to do with abandonment, and this is language that in our current severance tax isn't contemplated, this provision. This concept appeared in the resources CS and is not in the Senate CS, and I offer the amendment to the committee for further discussion and inclusion into the Senate CS. And Madam Chair, if I could ask Senator Terrio to help the committee.
Yeah. You could do it.
Madam Chair, I'm not prepared to talk about the details on this. Mm-hmm. It would help a lot if Senator Terrio could help.
Mm-hmm. Maybe Robin can help us.
Robin.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Robin Wilson again. Yes, through the chair, this amendment. This is the one that this allows costs of abandonment, and there was previously some discussion about some abandonment language, but we had some concerns about it in that it's at an extended period of disuse, and that was not very clear. And so that language has been taken out of here so that it addresses simply abandonment costs, removal costs.
In the previous version, in Senate Resources, that language, the extended period of disuse, was in that section.
Just a moment.
I can, Madam Chair, I can help with that. In conversations with the administration and Tom Williams at BP, it became clear that the words extended period of disuse were problematic when it comes to administering the tax. So Mr. Dickinson and Ms. Wilson indicated that the language needed to change or they would ask for the provision to be removed. They also indicated that they would work on the language to effectuate that change, and it has not arrived.
Madam Chairman, could I have Senator Wilkin repeat that last sentence?
They also indicated that they would work on the language to effectuate that change, and the language has not arrived.
So, Madam Chairman, this amendment is not in the entirety. There's more language coming, or am I confused? Yeah.
Okay, let's go back and just kind of give me a review again, Robin, what abandonment is.
Yes, Madam Chair. Abandonment would be the cost of closing up the well, and I appreciate any additional information from Mr. Mintz. But it is the cost of abandoning the well. The problem with the language that we have seen previously is it denied... In whether it was a credit or a deduction, what it denied was costs incurred for an extended period of disuse. And there's a number of facilities on the North Slope that may be not in use. They may be for backup purposes in case the main facility is down. And so then one wonders, well, are the costs allowed for that backup facility? Similarly, there may be facilities that are so-called mothballed, not with the intention of permanently abandoning them. So that was really the troublesome language, and that has been removed from the language presented as an amendment.
Well, how is abandonment handled right now?
In the CS, is that what you're...
No, currently in statute. What do we do with abandonment?
Well, Madam Chair, currently... Abandonment would be an upstream cost, and so it would not affect the production tax as it is.
Okay.
If that was what you were asking. Okay.
But abandonment is considered a legitimate, necessary business expense?
Yes, Madam Chair, it is.
generally by either the terms of the lease or the contract or...
Yes, you know. And there may be specific requirements through AOGCC. Mm-hmm. I'm not completely familiar with that, but that's what I would expect.
Okay, and in this particular insert is included in those expenditures that are not included. It does not include, as on page 20, line 23, earlier on 23, it says, on line 12, it says a direct cost includes a listing, and then on line 23, does not include. And this would be at the end of the does not includes.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. I believe in the resources CS, there was a prohibition against taking credits for abandonment. Mm-hmm. And in this current CS before you, or the finance CS, I believe there's no provision, so that would mean it's not addressed.
And that's correct.
So this would mean that costs would not be allowed for abandonment.
Against?
Against the production tax value. So you could not deduct abandonment costs. It would be at the end of 160D2.
Yeah, but is not the circumstance that since you're at the end of the line, you're not doing anything that accrues to, I'm not sure how it's phrased, investment, mm-hmm. exploration, and increasing your income?
Yes. And that is correct. It is sort of an ordinary and necessary part of doing business in the oil field, whether that's a acceptable deductible expense would be a policy call, and I would, you know, defer to the sponsor of the amendment to explain the policy reasoning.
Okay, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Correct me if I'm wrong, because abandonment is a usual business expense, it would be able to be deducted from income tax as a deduction, but because credits and PPT are aimed at increasing production, and abandonment doesn't increase production, obviously, then the abandonment costs could not be taken as a credit under PPT. So you can take it under income tax, but you can't take it under PPT.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, you are correct that abandonment costs would be deductible expense on the income tax. That is true. And I apologize, I've just now seen this amendment, this language, but my understanding is that this language fits in to page 21, mm-hmm. Line 20, and that is the end of the list of items that for which a deduction is not allowed. And then similarly...
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
But this amendment would not prohibit abandonment expenses from being deducted from an income tax.
No.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that is correct. You could still deduct it from the income tax.
And what would this do? What would it prevent it from doing?
Madam Chair, if we look at the list on page 20, this is explains what direct costs are or are not. So what this says, this amendment says that abandonment costs would not be direct cost for purposes of this, and that would mean it could not be deducted. And then similarly, there would be no credit.
Senator Stedman, and then Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chairman, I think this refers to just assets that are not used today before the effective date, and then if there's some phase in or some future use, if there's an allocation formula in here, and it would not be applicable to future items built after the effective date.
Okay. Thank you. I apologize. I Yes, attributable to production occurring before the effective date.
This is only relating to things before the effective date of this bill?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. Does somebody else have her hand? Oh, Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might suggest if we want, we could get the drafter on here, Ms. Chenoweth, to help us with the details if we, he is available over in the Terry Miller Building. This is not an insignificant amount of money that we're making the policy call here. I have, and if we could just take it just a very brief at ease, I'd like to ask Senator Terry a question.
Sure. Brief at ease.
Here, our consultant, who used to be in oil and gas for some number of years, and James Eason, wrote Ledge Budget and Audit, and I'd be more happy to distribute this letter, but I think page three, he made an estimate of what it would take to decommission the wells on just Cook Inlet, and this, of course, we'll give a credit for this. Just Cook Inlet, $1,007,699,000. So that is, in oil field terms, that's pretty short term. If you go out, and we're going to be asked to look ahead some 20 or 30 years with this agreement, if we look ahead to where we might start decommissioning Prudhoe Bay, and as we reach out to other fields, ANWR and MPRA, there was some discussion here about that, and although there is no firm number, just the number for North Star would perhaps be somewhere around $75 million, and then you can just extrapolate from there. But if it's $1 billion in Cook Inlet, to which today we have no provision, this policy call will expose those folks 20 years from now to what could only be known as billions of dollars of credit. So this is very much a policy call, and one that I think we need to make here. And this amendment simply says that we treat abandonment in the future as we have in the past for those pieces of those assets that are in play today. And, would you like to have this distributed?
That'd be fine. You'd be fine. Senator Olson.
Madam Chairman, as we look at this amendment, I'm wondering, are there any other drill sites or wells that have been that the abandonment has been allowed for, as in this amendment?
Well, this would refer to just to the signatories, to the
Do you understand my question, Madam Chair?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Robin,
yes.
Answer the question, please.
Senator Olson, through the chair, I am not aware of any wells having been formally abandoned in Alaska. And in referring to how they were previously treated, did I understand your question correctly?
First of all, my question wasn't whether they've been abandoned or not. The question was whether the cost of abandonment had been ever put into the contract as is provided with this PPT amendment.
I'm sorry, Senator Olson, the contract for the... What contract?
The gas pipeline?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Never having been one before.
No.
Okay,
The answer would be no. Am I not correct? Since the contract is not available, signed, or ready?
I don't know how it's handled in there.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this refers to a credit toward PPT. We never had a PPT before, so
that's right. It cannot have been in the past. Yeah, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification.
Okay.
This is to exclude existing infrastructure that's not used. There's a sharing relationship if it's not used today but used in the future, and it really doesn't impact anything built in the future after the effective date. Is that correct?
Go ahead, Robin. Are you just reading and reviewing?
I'm just reading. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I'm not entirely sure. I understand your point about it is attributable to the old production in terms of when the, well, that would make sense. If it was built after the effective date, then clearly it would be allowable.
Mm-hmm. So this predates the effective date. These provisions predate facilities.
Madam Chair, I believe the issue is if a facility is abandoned 2 months after this is effective, then most of the cost would be disallowed based on this formula that is in here, comparing the production before effective date to total production.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
Senator. Just for the committee's information, there are 16 platforms in Cook Inlet, four of which have been shut in or lighthoused, and those 16 are the ones that are listed on the letter that's being distributed for estimated to be $1 billion to decommission. Thank you.
And would this affect those wells, abandonment of those wells?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't hear the question.
He had just listed X number of dollars worth of wells in Cook Inlet. Would this pertain to Cook Inlet as well as the entire state, or would it be just to those?
Madam Chair, I don't see anything in the amendment that would differentiate areas, so I would assume that it had to do with the entire state.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Senator Wilkin, on this letter to Senator Terrio, it doesn't appear to be signed, and I was wondering why that is.
Brief please.
Sure.
Thank you.
Back on the record, any other questions? Okay, I'll maintain my objection. Would you correct the roll, please?
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Stedman?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Wilkin?
Yes.
Senator Green?
No.
5 yea, 2 nay.
Okay, so Amendment 11 is adopted.
Chair, move amendment number 14.
14?
I have 12.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
You want 12
I'm stacked up here.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Okay.
Amendment number 12.
I'll object for clarification.
Madam Chair, this has to do with royalty settlement agreements, RSAs. I don't have a depth of knowledge. Could Senator Terrio help us with this?
No.
Okay. Anybody else? Robin, would you be able to help explain what an RSA is and how it may relate to Senate Bill 305?
A royalty settlement agreement, and I do apologize, my knowledge is not very deep on that subject, but as I understand it, it's a settlement agreement with a specific royalty payor regarding their royalties. The reason that it's brought in with regard to SB 305 is that as we've gone along, Department of Revenue and Department of Natural Resources both calculate value on using the same information a little bit differently. There has traditionally been a little bit of difference in the ultimate value of the at the end of the day. I understand with the numbers that we're talking about, a little bit is certainly a lot. But in terms of one of the steps that was taken in terms of efficiency and simplicity, it was put in the original bill that, where there were royalty settlement agreements or the DNR value, that we could look to that to establish value. There's been a lot of discussion in the various committees about that.
Rob Mintz is on the line.
Yes, that would be helpful.
Have deeper knowledge on that. Rob, are you there?
Yes.
press the mute button again?
Yes, I am. Actually, it's the teleconference system that had me on mute.
Okay, could you help us with amendment number 12, please?
Okay, I'm looking at it for the first time, just this deck, so...
Okay, and it has to do with language we've included in section 25, having to do with, it says that under this subsection would improve the efficiency and economy of tax administration and result in calculations that represent value and actual cost of transportation, et cetera, et cetera. And goes on to say a formula prescribed by the department that uses with adjustments as appropriate a royalty value or valuation methodology accepted by DNR, Department of Interior, et cetera. And this would delete all of that material and add in, I believe, a prohibition, essentially, of using that methodology.
Okay, yes, Madam Chair, I see that. Well, it actually would have a broader effect on the current bill than just royalty settlement agreements. Actually, the royalty settlement agreement themselves were previously removed from the bill.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be three alternatives provided. One was royalty settlement agreements, and then there was other valuations, and then general provision for a simplified formula. And it looks like this amendment would remove all of those options so that the department would no longer be allowed to authorize a producer to use a simplified formula to calculate gross value at the point of production.
Mm-hmm. And what would be the impact of that?
Well, it would basically be, I mean, it would not have a material impact on revenues because the simplified formulas themselves were not intended to have a material impact. They were intended to improve the economy and efficiency of tax administration, basically both for the producers and the Department of Revenue, to kind of take advantage of of rules of thumb or ways of arriving at estimates of value that wouldn't require as much detailed specific information to be calculated every month and then be subject to specific audit in the future. So it's just really an administrative issue.
Okay.
I mean, I'm guessing that the concern behind the amendment is that there could be a material impact on revenues using simplified formulas, but certainly the intention of the original language was that there would not be, but it would simply be an administrative economy and efficiency.
Are there other questions or comments? Robin?
If I might, Madam Chair. I note that the current CS has specific language in there that these sort of shortcuts can only be used if the department determines that it would improve the efficiency and economy, and only if it doesn't systematically understate tax liability. So I think the department would be compelled to evaluate, if there was a material difference, then the simplified method could not be used.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. That would be my comment on that.
Okay, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Mr. Mintz, the result of these RSAs at the end of the day is that there's one producer that would be valuing their oil at a difference than the other producers. Is that not correct?
Madam Chairman, Senator Wilkin. Well, that's potentially correct. However, I'd point out that line 18 and 19 of page 17 says adjustments is appropriate. I mean, if the department looked at a formula and thought that the formula, say, would tend to understate the value by 50 cents a barrel, then it could add 50 cents a barrel to the formula to make up for that. So in detail, there could be variations among producers, but I think that the intent is that they wouldn't be material over the long term.
Our consultant, Econ One, estimated that under the current law that the value of the RSAs over the next 10 years is projected to be at $300 million. Does that, are you qualified to verify that?
Madam Chairman, Senator Wilkin, no, I'm not.
Okay. Part of the issue with RSAs is that some producers can reduce the amount they pay the state because of their transportation costs. Is that correct?
Well, transportation costs are a deduction for royalty values, just as they are for the production tax. And I believe it's the case that there may be variations among RSAs in how transportation costs are handled.
Yeah.
But in every case, the aim of the RSA would be to have a reasonable, accurate way of stating the transportation costs.
Let's see. That's all I have for now, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Stedman?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to hear from Robin if she thinks the way the bill is written now is going to be problematic and put the state at a disadvantage in the enforcement of or collection of taxes.
As in version P?
As in version
P. In the
P.
amendment. Okay,
yeah,
as in correct. Version P. Okay, Robin, could you help us with that?
Yes, Senator Stedman, through the chair. I believe the way the bill is currently written, it would not disadvantage the state. I think it does place a responsibility on the department to evaluate, if it's efficient and economical, and that includes, if the amount of revenue that would be at stake, that would have to be considered. And also it places a responsibility on the state to make sure that we don't look at a formula that is biased towards understating the tax liability. So I believe that the language as it is currently drafted places an adequate burden on the state to make sure that the formula is economical and efficient and doesn't forego material revenue.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Oh, Senator Stedman. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mintz, Robin, in past working this bill the last few months, there's been testimony that perhaps we have a legal problem because of equal protection under the Constitution, and there is possible litigation if we continue the RSAs. Could you help me with the discussion that you folks have participated in?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I would defer to Mr. Mintz. I'm not qualified as an attorney.
Okay. Mr. Mintz, do you have any information on that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Wilkin. Equal protection is concerned with disparate treatment of similarly situated persons. And the courts look at equal protection questions with different standards depending on the type of interest that's involved. When it comes to taxation, the courts have been lenient in terms of upholding distinctions and different treatment. I cannot guarantee anyone with 100% certainty that there could not be a successful equal protection challenge here. However, I think it's very doubtful that that would be successful. I think that the considerations of tax administration would probably be sufficient to justify whatever relatively minor difference in treatment would occur or might occur under this provision.
Okay. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Any other comments? I maintain my objection. Roll call, please.
Senator Dyson?
Pass.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Stedman?
No.
Senator Bundy?
No.
Senator Dyson?
pass.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Green?
You want to complete calling the roll first?
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Green?
No.
Two yeas, five nays.
Madam Chair, move, oh, pardon me.
Amendment number 12, please.
Madam Chair, move amendment number 13.
I'll object for explanation.
Madam Chair, this has to do with the tools that are in the toolbox of our state government in order to audit. And this would put in place, if the department chose to use the concepts of the Internal Revenue Code when it comes to auditing the producers and having the state paid properly under the legislation that's being considered. This doesn't create any obligation on behalf of the, as I understand it, on behalf of the state, only allows them, should they see the need, to use this as a way to better assess and validate the requirement for the producers to pay the people of Alaska for their resources. Thank you.
Okay, Robin, I've heard you speak on this in resources, but I don't quite remember what your opinion of USC 482 was, but it seemed like it was, you had something to say, and I'm not sure what it was. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In the Resources Committee, this topic did come up, and what we said, I believe both Mr. Dickinson and myself said that we do not feel this is necessary. However, it may be another tool. Mm-hmm. And just a little background about what this is about. Potentially, there could be a problem of intercompany transfers, and I believe we have language in here right now that says if it's over fair market value, that it's not allowable. So I believe the question came up from legislative consultants as to whether we would need more power in terms of auditing. 482 is a federal code section that deals with transfer pricing, and the ability of the Internal Revenue Service to audit usually offshore transactions is where it comes up federally. I would say that, you know, 482 has some advantages and disadvantages. I think it provides a range of possible values, so there's some flexibility there, you know, for the producer. You know, no one expects the department to quibble about, let us say, a $4 million drill bit that, because of, you know, conditions of weather or timing, had to pay $4.5 million. You know, the issue comes up possibly where $10 million is paid for a $4 million drill bit. So I don't have strong feelings one way or the other. We have said before we don't think it's necessary, but if it's the pleasure of the committee to provide that tool, that's fine. 482 audit, the disadvantage is 482 audits are very time consuming and they're very hard. There's a lot of looking at contracts and so on. So there are advantages and disadvantages to them.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to confirm this was permissive but not mandatory.
Through the Chair, Senator Money, that is correct, because it's the section, I believe, starts out, the department may write regulations, and this expands that to may write regulations, including those incorporating 482.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, I think this is one of the times you look down the wrong end of binoculars, and let's remember that what we're doing here with this legislation, we may be asked to, this may have an horizon of 15, 20, 30 years. So as the producers over time become more sophisticated in their analysis and in their efforts to pay correctly, I think that perhaps 10 or 15 or 30 years from now, we need to have every tool in the toolbox that we have should we need it, and this amendment allows that.
Is there any point, Senator Stedman, go ahead.
This is a follow-up, Madam Chairman. Maybe we can get an explanation of how this system's going to work if it is somehow untouched for a decade or longer, with the federal government changing the federal tax statutes from time to time. I assume the federal tax statutes will still be applicable to whatever is going on in the state of Alaska, regardless of how much someone may want to cast this in stone.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, of course, it's certainly possible that the federal code, you know, may be completely revamped at some point. There are a couple of other areas in the PPT bill where we refer to Internal Revenue Code, for example, in defining ordinary and necessary. I would point out that this amendment is again discretionary, and so I guess my comment on future changes in the Internal Revenue Code, if, for example, we did write regulations that incorporated the requirements of 482 and found that down the road, 10 or 15 years, if they completely revamped the Internal Revenue Code so that 482 didn't make sense in this context, that I would expect those regulations to be revised.
Okay. Is that, can I answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah. Could you, if you chose without this sentence in here, use USC 482 or 26 USC?
Madam Chair, yes, given the language that prohibits expenses in excess of fair market value, mm-hmm. if we did not have this adoption language, mm-hmm. and if I was faced with potentially a transfer pricing issue, I think I would probably pick up the Internal Revenue Code for reference and see, gee, how does the federal government do it as a starting point? I think that there's probably some guidelines as far as what things to look at, whether it's contracts of other suppliers or just what. So I would probably use it, if nothing else, as a reference.
The language used here on line 16, necessary to carrying out the purposes of this section, comma, including the incorporation of the concept, da 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 da. Do you place this in a higher order than any of the other options you choose to do your audit and working on the different documents handed to you? Or does this create a confusion? Or someone, you calculate it a different way and they say, well, why didn't you calculate it under this?
Madam Chair, if I might ask the assistance of Mr. Mintz, because I believe that is sort of a legal question.
Okay. Okay, Rob?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think that's a very good question. And what you may be getting at is that there's a kind of canon or principle of statutory construction,
right,
that where there are certain examples enumerated in a statute, that the presumption is that other instances should kind of be similar or fall in the same general category as that list of examples. I'm not sure that that would really be too much of a consideration here, because it's really not much of a list. It's just mm-hmm. pretty much singling out one or two sources, and they're only relevant to aspects of AS 4255-160, and there are other types of issues that would come up that wouldn't really be relevant. So I'm not sure that it's, I mean, as I say, it's a good question. I'm not sure that it would really be a problem, though.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions? Any other comments? Take the roll, please.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Stedman?
No.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Green?
No.
3A, 4A.
So Amendment 13 fails.
Madam Chair, move Amendment number 14.
Okay, and I will object for explanation.
Madam Chair, this has to do with FERC, and I had a chance to take FERC in college, and I took PE instead. So could I get some help from Senator Terrio on this one?
Nope.
Okay, let me tell you what I know about FERC. This is in the Section 12, which is the tax credits for certain losses and expenditures. And all this is saying is that if we give the producers, the builder of an asset, a credit, which, of course, this bill is all about, if we give them that credit and they realize that, then they would say, when we go to FERC to establish the tariff for hauling the product north to south, they would say, yes, we got a credit, and they would be in concert with us asking FERC to take that credit that they got and not have it deducted from the cost of that asset of building it, and therefore it would be 22% less or some percent less, and therefore result in a lower tariff. Obviously, the lower the tariff, two things happen. The less we pay to haul the product, and the more the people realize. And the other is that the lower the tariff, the more accessible the pipeline is to other people as far as new producers that want to come in for the next 15, 20, or 30 years. We'll have a lower tariff. It'll be easier for them to price their product. We'll have more explorers and more producers. So that's all this is, and this may not happen for a few years, but this establishes the policy, and it says to FERC that we have realized that we have given the credit, and the producers would come with us and be our partners in saying all we want is to realize the money we have gotten back from the state, and those monies should be reflected in a lower tariff. That means more money for the people of Alaska, and enables access to those people that are going to come and explore and produce in our state. So that's what this does. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other comments about this? I just want to be sure that everyone knows that the end of this says that what this is really asking is that the a producer, explorer, or other taxpayer that obtains a tax credit, et cetera, shall at all times support and in all rate proceedings filed to flow through 100% of the tax credits. And I, for one thing, I joined some others in thinking this is probably a little premature for us to be getting into this. And the others, I think that's kind of a, I would do it backward. I would say you receive the credit until FERC says no, and then you change around the way it's done. Did you have your hand up, Senator Stedman? Yes, sir.
I'd like to add to that, Madam Chairman, that over the last 3 months, we've been working on this supposedly standalone oil tax bill. This is an issue with the gas line and some of these policy calls. I think we should take them up at a later time into the special session or whenever we're going to handle this. But at some point, we're going to have to make this call. Some of the language here might need to be worked on a little bit, but the issue is a good issue that needs to be discussed and the policy drawn early on from the state's perspective, so we don't get caught in a position where we think or feel that there's a high certainty that FERC will act one way and they act another as we grant. Right now we have a 25% credit in our bill. We grant a 25% credit on the construction of these assets, which, like Senator Wilkins said, is they're going to lower their equity position. Then the question is, what happens to the tariff? So I don't support this at this time, but I would like to deal with this when we deal with the gas line.
Thank you. Are there any other comments? Any other questions? I have maintained my objection. Take the roll, please.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Stedman?
No.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Green?
No.
3A, 4A.
And Amendment number 14 fails. There aren't any more amendments, are there?
Chairman, we can come up with some if you would like.
Oh, thank you. I think we'll pass. We could. Are there any questions? Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, this morning we had the issue of what we've come to know as the Anadarko issue. Is there some sort of... We took it out because I think we all were somewhat concerned about the impact. Are we going to revisit that at some time, or is there some disposition to that
issue? I think that the language we have right now is probably not ready to be included, and we'll assume that if that language gets improved and is either ready for the floor or in the House, it'll be included at that time, or it'll be taken up in future. Time out. Thank you, Robin. Yes, at ease, please. Would you please pull out amendment number 7?
The amended number 7.
Amended amendment number 7. There was a phrase included that is not supposed to be included. And what I would prefer to do is introduce amendment number 15 relating to page 22, line 1. In this amendment number 7, it's on page 3, line 18, 17 and 18. Robin, would you please explain?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I would refer you to pages 19 and 20 in the bill before you.
Move the amendment.
Oh, I will. I move amendment number 15. Thank you.
Object for explanation.
Sorry, what page again?
Yes, I would refer you to pages, the bottom of page 19 of your bill and the top of page 20. What this section does is say that where a producer receives reimbursement for costs, then those that would have to be offset against the lease expenses. And so if...
Robin, do you mean the bottom of page 21? And the top of page 22?
I'm sorry, you're right.
Thank you. Okay,
I apologize.
See the bottom of page 21.
Yes.
And go to the top of page 22.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. As I said, this section requires the producer to add back reimbursements to offset them against lease expenses. And there was a question about, well, gee, what happens for the tax credits? Isn't that a credit that should be added back? If you look at the top of page 22, it says payments or credits. And the intention was not to add back tax credits. So amendment number 7 added the language other than tax credits under this chapter, which suggests that tax credits other than under this chapter would have to be added back. And it was the intention, I understand, to just be clear about tax credits in general, not to require the add back, for example, of the federal enhanced oil recovery credit or any other credits. So the suggested change here for the amendment number 15 is to delete the words under this chapter. And so it would simply say, tax credits other than tax, or I'm sorry, payments or credits other than tax credits.
Received by the producer.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Is there any objection to that amendment? Amendment number 15 is adopted. Thank you. Are there any other questions? There are no more amendments. Senator Bundy?
The number.
305.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I would move that we report from committee finance substitute for Senate Bill 305 as multiply amended with individual recommendations.
With love and affection, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there objection? Senate Bill 305 as amended moves from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. And I want to thank everyone at the table for all their ideas and all the things brought to this. This has been certainly not one of the easiest we've ever dealt with, but one that I think we've all learned more than we ever wanted to learn and
have the opportunity to continue doing so, and for all of you from industry, from the department, and all the different legislators who've been here and staff, thank you very much for all your work, and thank you very much.
What time is the floor?
We will be, just a brief at ease, four? We will go on, okay, back on the record. We will be going in, and one other brief at ease. Okay. Back on the record, capital budget, Monday morning. So, we're adjourned.